ran across this story in one of Tony Campolo's books, and it evidently is a true story. He tells the story of a friend of his who was a counselor. He was counseling a man who came to him and said that he was falling out of love with his wife. The counselor advised the man to think of all the ways he could to make life happier for his wife, and then to do them. A few days later, the counselor received a phone call in which the husband related the following story. He said, "Every day I leave for work, put in a hard day, come home dirty and sweaty and stumble in the back door, go to the refrigerator, get something to drink, and then go to the rec room and watch television until supper time. After talking to you," he said, "I decided I would do better than that in the future. So yesterday, before I left work, I showered, I shaved, I put on a clean shirt, and on the way home, I stopped at the florist and bought a bouquet of flowers. Instead of going to the back door, as I usually do, I went to the front door and I rang the doorbell. My wife opened the door and took one look at me and started to cry. When I asked her what was wrong, she said, 'It's been a horrible day. Billy broke his leg and had to have it put in a cast. And I no sooner returned home from the hospital when your mother called and said she was coming to stay with us for 3 weeks. And I tried to do the wash, and the washing machine broke, and there's water all over the basement. And now you've come home drunk." Yeah, I can believe that response. It's hard to know who it is that we can trust. Who do we believe? The message this morning will help us with that question. It's hard to know who to trust. Who do we believe? Are they just putting on an act? Or are they sincere? And it's very hard to trust someone who has hurt us. Someone who has disappointed us. Over the years, I've heard many people express this dilemma. They'll say something like this: "I'm willing to forgive, but how can I trust? How can I trust them again? How can I trust that person who hurt me, who disappointed me?" Well, Joseph is in that particular position as we take up our story again this week. Now, last week we noted already how Joseph has dealt with his brethren who have come to Egypt to buy grain during the famine. He has not revealed to them who he is. He is second in command in all of Egypt. A wonderful story of God's sovereignty and God's grace there. Joseph turned the tables on his brothers in these ways. He said, "You all are spies." And they said, "No, we're honest men." Remember, if you go back a few weeks, maybe a few months now, when we talked about Joseph when he was a young man, being sent of his father to bring the report of his brethren who were out in the field keeping the sheep. And they resented his checking on them. And then you remember how they put Joseph in the pit and they confined him there until they decided what to do. They would have killed him if it hadn't been for the intervention of one of the brothers. And so Joseph puts all of the brothers in jail, if you will, and incarcerates them for 3 days. And then finally he lets them all go back with this requirement. They had to come back again and bring the other brother, Benjamin, his natural brother through Rachel, and he kept Simeon confined and imprisoned until they came back. So he literally turned the tables on them and did to them the very things in kind that they had done to him. It wasn't because Joseph had not forgiven them. I believe that he had forgiven them, and we'll find more evidence of that next week. But forgiveness is a choice of the will that is a conscious decision to withhold repayment in kind. Forgiveness means that we decide not to retaliate, not to seek revenge, not to extract pain for pain. Joseph could have treated them very harshly. You say, well, that was kind of harsh. Well, it was a test. Joseph had not revealed himself, and he won't reveal himself even yet this week. We'll get to that again next week. But Joseph wants to know, has there been any change in their character? He has forgiven them in the sense that he is not going to, execute them or imprison them for the rest of their life or deny them grain so they starve. None of that. He's willing to look past that offense, but he wants to know, has there been any change in their character? Because unless there has been some change, there cannot really be any true reconciliation. Now, whether you describe forgiveness as having two aspects, the non-retaliatory aspect and the reconciliation prospect, some describe it that way, or whether they're two separate things, as we're talking about it this morning. Forgiveness being the choice not to repay, reconciliation being the restoration of a loving, kind, active, and vital relationship. And that Joseph does not have yet with his brothers, and he is not about to assume it or anticipate it, especially not on his behalf, until he knows that there has been some change in their life. So, how do we trust again? You see, the question, as I posed it a few moments ago, that I have often heard, how can I trust someone again? It's really the wrong question. It's not a how question at all. You see, trust can only be earned. So it's not a how question. It's not how can I work it up? How can I manufacture it? How can I trust them again? No, it's a question of when, not how. It's a question of when is it deserved? And for true and complete reconciliation, they have got to acknowledge their sin, fess up to it, and then they've got to present some evidence. Some evidence that will be evidence for a complete reconciliation. So reconciliation requires the evidence of change. That's what Joseph is after. That's what he's looking for as we come to chapter 42, and we're going to begin at verse 29. Beginning at chapter 42, verse 29, Joseph now is seeking to determine whether there's any evidence of any change in his brothers. What evidence is he looking for? What evidence does he probe for? What is it that we can look to in the same way? Well, there are two observable types of confirming evidence of true change or repentance in the heart of someone that has hurt us, disappointed us, purposefully, whatever. And the first one is an attitude of submission. An attitude of submission. Chapter 42, verse 29. They have returned home. They have brought the grain. Verse 29. Then they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him all that had happened to them, saying, "The man who is lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, 'We are honest men, we are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more. The youngest is with his father this day in the land of Canaan.' Then the man, the lord of the country, said to us, 'By this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me and take food for the famine of your household and be gone, and bring your youngest brother to me.'" This was his test. Now, Joseph had to know He had to know that it would be almost impossible for Jacob to allow Benjamin, now his youngest, the only other son he had through Rachel, his beloved. It would be almost impossible for Jacob to allow him to depart with these other brothers if they had not achieved some level of trust in the eyes of Jacob. Verse 36. And Jacob, their father, said to them, "You have bereaved me. Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and you want to take Benjamin. All these things are against me." Well, then Reuben speaks to his father in verse 37 and says, "Well, you know, you can kill my two sons if I don't bring him back." And Joseph promptly ignores Reuben. There's a reason for that. We won't get into it. We'll come back to that later, perhaps. Verse 38, but he said, "My son shall not go down with you," verse 38. "For his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which he go, then you will bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave." Now, what do you think the brothers did? Well, they could have taken Benjamin and went anyway. And I suggest to you that those brothers at an earlier stage in their life and career would have done just that. Well, they were willing to kill Joseph. At least the majority of them were earlier on. And all but one was willing to sell him into slavery as they did. Would they bring Benjamin against the will of Jacob? They do not. They do not. Chapter 43, verse 1. Now the famine was severe in the land, and it came to pass when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt that their father said to them, "Go back, buy a little food." But he didn't say, "Go back and take Benjamin." He says, "Just go back and get some more food." But Judah spoke to him, saying, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you.'" In verse 8 of chapter 43, then Judah said to Israel, his father, "Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and all our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him, if you do not bring him back to you and set him before you. Then let me bear the blame forever." Now he listens to Judah. Judah, of all the brothers, seems to have the most sincere change of heart. And you remember that whole story of Judah earlier, where in his sin, I think, God began to get through to him. But you see here the submission, first of all, to the family structure. The willing submission to Jacob and Jacob's desire. And it is only when Jacob is finally convinced that they go back and take with them Benjamin. Verse 11, chapter 43, and their father said to them, "If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits and of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the man, a little balm, a little honey, spices, myrrh, pistachio, and almonds. Take double money, and then verse 13, more importantly, take your brother." Verse 14, he says, "And may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may release your other brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved." So Jacob gives his permission, and they do nothing until he does. They demonstrate submission to their father, but they also demonstrate from this point on an attitude of submission toward Joseph and the authority that he held, the governmental authority he held as the one who basically held all the cards. It's the only place there was any grain. The influence and the decisions of Egypt would bear on them and determine whether or not they would survive. Going back to verse 42 at verse 30, "The man who is lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies." And then they tell the brothers, you know, "Go bring back the younger brother to prove that you're not a spy." And he kept Simeon in surety for their return. And now in verse 15 of chapter 43, so the men took the present and Benjamin, and they took double the money in their hand, and they rose and went down to Egypt, and they stood before Joseph. Now they have a problem. You remember, Joseph put their money back in their provisions, in their sacks. So they really hadn't paid for the grain that they got the first time. That's why Jacob said, go take double money back. So are they going to confess this? Are they going to try to make this right? Are they going to acquiesce to the authority of Joseph and do what's right? Or are they just going to act like they never knew what happened? Verse 16, when Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, take these men to my home and slaughter an animal, make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon. Look at verse 18. Now the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house, and they said, it is because of the money which was returned in our sacks the first time, and we are brought in so that he may make a case against us and seize us and take us as slaves with our donkeys. When they drew near to the house of Joseph's, when they drew near to the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door. So before they even go in, they're confessing, "Hey, we got a problem here. We're bringing back the money." Verse 20, and they said, "Oh, sir, we indeed came down the first time to buy food." And then in verse 21, he tells them that the money was put back in their sacks and so on. The servant tells them, "Do not be afraid." And then in verse 26, Joseph returns, and Joseph came home, and they brought him the present, which was in their hand, into the house. And look at this, and they bowed down before him to the earth. You remember the dream that Joseph had of his brothers bowing down to him. Second time this has happened now. It happened the first time back in when they first came down. And he asked them about the well-being of their father in verse 27, if he's still alive and so on. And they answered, your servant, your father is in good health and he is still alive. And look at this. And they bowed down their heads and prostrated themselves. Third time. Then Joseph lifts up his eyes. He sees Benjamin. He's overcome with emotion and departs for a little while. And we'll come back to this. But ultimately, he sends them back with food, and this time he puts a very expensive cup in the sack of Benjamin, as if Benjamin had stolen it. And when it was discovered, they come back to Joseph in chapter 44. Look at verse 18. They all come back. Verse 14, of chapter 44. So Joseph and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell down before him on the ground. Again, the fourth time. You know what? This time, they didn't bow down. This time it says they fell down. They were in big trouble at this point. And Joseph said to them, what deed is this you have done? And in verse 16, and Judah said, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants, and we are the Lord's servants, both we, that's important, we, and he also with whom the cup was found. So Joseph says, we're all your slaves. They're not going to leave Benjamin alone and go home. And Joseph says, far be it from me, verse 17, that I do that, but the man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And then Joseph gives him the whole story about Benjamin and so on. But there is a complete submission to Joseph and to the governing authority and to those that they had offended here that is demonstrated. Then number three, ultimately, submission is always to God. Now I want you to look once again at verse 16 of chapter 44. And Judah said, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants, and we are your Lord, my Lord's slaves. You know, they were submissive to God. They accepted the sovereignty of God as he had worked this out and accepted what looked to them like their sentence for their evil, past and otherwise. Joseph is witness to this demonstration of a newfound character in his brothers, doing things that they would have never done previously. Submissive, most of all and foremost, to the ultimate authority, God Himself. So, an attitude of submission is evidence of a changed heart. If someone cannot be obedient to authority that they are under, you cannot trust them. That is just the way things are. If you know somebody who refuses to be obedient, refuses to, with a good attitude, submit to authority that be over them, they cannot be trusted. Unless there is a significant change that is demonstrated, and that's number two. The second evidence of true change is a demonstration, a public demonstration of righteousness. Now let's go back in our context once again. Aren't you glad I told you to read these three chapters ahead of time? You might be a little lost if you didn't get that word, but we're doing the best I can to keep you up. Let's go back to chapter 43, verse 11. Verse 11, "And their father Israel said to them, 'If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best of the fruits,'" and all that he describes in the rest of the verse. And then in verse 12 he says, "Take double money in your hand, and take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight." Wow. They demonstrated their righteousness by basic honesty. Jacob says, "Take the money back. You shouldn't have this money and the grain." Let's go over to chapter 43 and verse 20 again. And they're speaking to the servant at the door before they go into Joseph's house. "And said, 'Oh, sir, we indeed came down the first time to buy food. But it happened, when we came to the encampment, that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight, so we have brought it back in our hand.'" Here is a demonstration of basic honesty, basic trustworthiness in the matter of financial affairs. No doubt. That's why Joseph put the money there as a test, to see what they would do, to see what their character might be. But there's an even greater demonstration here in our story, and there are many, many ways in which we demonstrate our faithfulness to the Word of God, our morality. There are many ways in life that we do good and demonstrate to others our character. There's a couple of them here. We see the basic honesty, the return of the money, but here's the big one: self-sacrificing love. Whenever a person is willing to put somebody else's good ahead of their own good, or to care about someone else at their own expense, when that is demonstrated, that's perhaps the best of all, the best way of all in which you can demonstrate a real God-influenced and God-changed character. So let's take a look at this at chapter 43, now down at I want to back up just a little bit from what I got marked here. Let's go back to verse 29. After they come and bow down to him, they're in Joseph's house, they're about to receive the meal. Joseph sees Benjamin in verse 29. He's overcome with emotion, and he departs. And he goes into his chamber, and he weeps in verse 30. And then after a while, in verse 31, he washes his face and comes out, and he restrained himself. And he said, "Serve the bread." Now, verse 32 is key. "So they set him in a place by himself," that's Joseph, "and them by themselves," that's Joseph's brothers, and the Egyptians who ate with them by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat food with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. Now, that's just custom there in the last part. And Joseph had to remove himself from his brothers because he hasn't revealed who he is at this point. Verse 33. And they sat before him. Now, here's his brothers. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. In other words, Joseph had the stewards, the servants, seat them in accordance with their birth order. And the men, this is Joseph's brothers, and the men looked in astonishment at one another, because they got to be thinking, how does he know who's the oldest? They just all look like a bunch of scruffy shepherds. I mean, we know, okay, he could probably pick out Benjamin, who's around 20, but the rest of them, how would he possibly know their birth order? Verse 34. And this is particularly interesting. Then he took servings to them from before him. But Benjamin's serving was five times as much as any of theirs. Why did he do that? Well, there's evidently a custom among the Egyptians, if you really wanted to honor someone, you gave them five times more food than anybody else. It wasn't that it was expected that it be consumed. It was just a statement of honor. Now, here Joseph goes to the youngest by order of birth, and honors him above all the rest. Why did he do that? What was it that Joseph's father Jacob did? Remember, he made him that coat, the multicolored coat that probably represented something about his birthright and his inheritance, and certainly his father's favoritism. And it was part of the reason why his brothers were jealous and hated him. So now, how are they going to respond to Benjamin if Benjamin is honored? Again, another test of their character. Now, that's important because it leads up to what happens in chapter 44. In verse 2 of chapter 44, when they're about to go back with the grain, Joseph tells his servant, "Put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his grain money." So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. Verse 3, as soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, and their donkeys. When they had gone out of the city and were not yet far off, Joseph said to his servant, "Get up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks, with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing.'" So he overtook them and he spoke to them these same words. Now, I don't think that we're necessarily here in any regard to believe that Joseph practiced a pagan ritual of divination and used this cup. But he would have been expected to have that in his home as a good Egyptian. Joseph obviously didn't do that, and Joseph had a connection with God and was able to interpret dreams as he had done with Pharaoh. He's just using an item that was handy as a test. Now, what's going to happen? Let's drop down to verse 13 when they're brought back. Then they, this is all the brothers, they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house and was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, "What deed is this you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?" And Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found." And then Joseph says, "No, it's just going to be the guilty one." And the rest of the chapter, Judah stands up and says, "Look, his father will die if I don't bring him back. You've got to take me instead." It's an act of self-sacrificing love. And here is where Joseph knew that they would not sell out Benjamin for their own good. And that was crucial for him to know, because they had sold him out those, what, almost 30 years earlier. They had sold him out of just pure jealousy for their own good. But they don't do it this time. So they're brothers through this whole long process that we read here in these chapters, through all the steps that Joseph takes and the care he takes to conceal himself and to make sure these things happen in such a way. He does it to test them to see what their character was. And their righteousness, their change of heart, was demonstrated by their honesty and by their self-sacrificing love toward Benjamin. You say, well, how do you know when someone has demonstrated enough? How do we really know when we get to that point when we can trust them? Can I ask you a few questions? How do you know you're going to get paid next payday? You all have a payday if you work as a job, you know. Maybe Friday, maybe Monday, maybe once a month, every 2 weeks. How do you know when payday comes you're going to get a check? Well, the truth of the matter is you don't really know. The company could go bankrupt between now and then. But you are working those hours, you're putting in that time because they've always paid you that paycheck. And you've come to have confidence in it. Let me ask you a question. How do you know when you sit down to eat that the food is edible? Well, if it's at home, you've got a long track record, you know, your wife hasn't poisoned you yet, you know, you're probably going to be all right. And if you go out to a restaurant, how do you know if you go into McDonald's, you're not going to eat the food and get sick? Because you've eaten at McDonald's hundreds of times, that's how. I mean, you could get sick. You know, no one knows for sure you won't get sick, but you've got a long track record there that gives you confidence. How do you know that your husband's going to do that list of chores? Now, let's skip that one. That was a bad illustration. Anything we go to do, anything that we place confidence in, any trust that we have, it's never 100% sure, unless it's some promise of God. But we come to a point, we come to a level of confidence in certain situations. How do you know when you go to the faucet and turn the handle, the water's going to come out? It may not. The water may be cut off. But generally speaking, water always comes out. How do you know the car's going to start? Well, it doesn't always start. You don't have 100%, but generally speaking, when you turn that switch, your car starts. And you have a level of confidence that that's going to happen. You don't worry about it. I don't know at what point, but I do know there comes a point, or there can come a point, when you have a level of confidence in another person that you are able then to accept them in full reconciliation of the relationship. So who can we trust? Obedient people. Submissive people are trustworthy. Righteous people. People who do the right thing. If you're around someone and they cut corners, they don't tell the truth, they cheat other people, they do this, they do that, distance yourself from that person. They're not trustworthy. If they can't follow directions, if they can't yield to authority, if they're always complaining about everything, trying to do everything their own way, unwilling to be submissive, you're not going to be able to trust that person. And then when you have been hurt specifically, what do? Well, you forgive. Forgiveness means leave it in God's hands. I will repay, saith the Lord. Do not retaliate. Do not repay evil for evil. Do good instead to someone who hurts you. But then number two, it takes a lot of patience. You've got to demonstrate a lot of patience and wait until trust is restored, if it is. Until you come to a level of comfort where you can have that complete restoration in your relationship.